Hi everyone, welcome back. This is Chander in Palo Alto.
Hi, this is Arne in Oslo.
And you're listening to Valley Nordic, a podcast about business, culture, and technology from Silicon Valley perspective and Nordic perspective. And today we are going to discuss, you know, what's on everybody's mind. That's the war happening in Ukraine, and we'll talk about the implications of that war on the world in three different areas. One is climate / energy, second defense, and third is self-reliance, and also our hopes and prayers for all the people who are being impacted by the war. And we wish everybody in that region safety and end of it soon. Okay, shall we get started?
Yeah, I think we should. And just to echo that last point, I mean, we're talking about, global implications, which are indirect implications and are very small compared to direct implications. So unfortunately, the Ukraine is bearing the brunt of all this madness that impacts the rest of the world, but to a much lesser extent, obviously.
Yeah. So let's start first with energy. And I think most people might know this, but I can quickly rephrase or repeat. I think one of the biggest exports from Russia is gas and oil. And Europe, especially Germany, is heavily reliant on Russian gas and oil. And a lot of the heating at homes works on gas in Germany. And I was talking to a friend of mine in Germany a couple of weeks ago before the war started. The prices have gone up 4x already, 4x. So it, it's huge dependence. And now with this war happening, they can't cut off gas from Russia because then they'll freeze. But they also, so the sanctions that the world is putting Russia on, these, they're not applicable to gas and oil from Russia. So Europe, Germany can have that. But longer term, they'll have to find some other ways to become more self-reliant. And I think Arne has a good hypothesis of what that is and how that may help the environment. Over to you, Arne.
Yeah, I'd actually like to extend the point that you have a little bit, Chander. I think all of Europe is actually dependent on gas from Russia. Or it's not just a German issue. Mm. That said, I think German bears a particular responsibility, and in my mind have had what I would call an ostrich policy that was very good intended, but it's actually partially responsible for putting, driving the situation to where it is now. Not directly responsible, but giving Putin the opportunity to do so. He has thought, and probably misjudged, that he has significant strategic leverage over Europe because of the situation. And it's been expanded. The good intention is, of course, to make Germany more sustainable and investing in renewable energy, which is good, but it's also been mixed up with decommissioning nuclear power. Mm-hmm. And also to some extent coal. This is a consequence of Fukushima. And by that, the coverage of energy has gone up to be covered by natural gas significantly over the last 10 years due to this German decision. And this is what has given Russia this leverage now. So I think this is a very, very unfortunate backdrop. And only now Europe is waking up and said, my God, if this continues, we have to make a stand now, even if it's painful. We should have been able to put an even bigger stand, but we cannot let this happen more in the future. So I think this will have an effect directly on the mix of energy, and I think particularly it will accelerate further investment in renewable generation, like wind and sun and offshore wind and so forth. It will increase investments in energy efficiency. So, for example, you have more heat pumps and so forth for, you know, heating rather than direct heating. Maybe alternative energy like hydrogen. But I also think nuclear will make a comeback. So in France, France and Finland, for example, have been investing in nuclear while Germany has been decommissioning it. I think this will turn around for all of Europe, that nuclear will be back, and that you will see an energy mix in Europe that's leaning heavily and accelerated to energy and renewable energy, energy efficiency, and nuclear. And so if there is a silver lining to this situation at all, I think it's that it's good for the climate.
Yeah. So France, I think, has 75% to 80% of energy comes from nuclear.
Something like that, yeah. And France is one of the most advanced nuclear suppliers of technology in the world.
Yeah. And to remind everyone, the Fukushima incident happened, you know, I think 10 years or so ago in Japan, where there was accident in the nuclear reactor. And that's when, you know, lives were lost and there was big disaster in Japan. And as a result of that, Germany decided to get off nuclear. That's what Arne was referring to, Fukushima. Go ahead.
They decommissioned multiple nuclear power plants last year, and they were meant to decommission, if everything goes according to plan, are going to decommission the last nuclear power plants this year. Mm-hmm. And just to be fair, when I say that nuclear will make a return, I'm talking about nuclear energy and hopefully not nuclear arms, although that might also be in effect. And nuclear energy is, of course, a very contentious issue. Nuclear is energy, and all things nuclear are very perceived very dangerous, and weapons are extremely dangerous. But I think the if you look at the numbers, the perceived danger of it is much bigger than the actual danger of it, although I know I'm climbing on a limb here and a lot of people disagree with this point.
Okay, I will, you know, our conversation will go in another direction if I dig deeper here. So let's leave it at that. So, okay, the second one is defense. And I see defense in three areas or three sections. One is cyber, you know, that's becoming big part of how you can harm another nation. Second is weapons, and third is surveillance. So there'll be more spending in these three areas of defense. And I see that as more of a European thing rather than, you know, worldwide. This happening, that the countries increasing their defense spending. What do you think, Arne?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think that, you know, there's been a claim over the last few years, and rightly so, I guess, that the Western Europeans are not spending enough to defend themselves. The numbers bear that fact. Of course, it becomes a very contentious issue when you have one of the most stupid presidents ever putting that point across in the wrong way. However, I think the current situation is a big wake-up call. And so Germany has been understanding for a long time and has made the pledge to both a one-time big spending package as well as to increasing the annual spend on a GDP basis. And I think certainly more or less all of Western Europe will follow suit. This has been a wake-up call. I don't think it necessarily is 100% isolated to Europe. I think the US have been spending a lot all along. Mm-hmm. I think there's a risk of it going into like back in time to an arms race situation again. But I think certainly European democracies have woken up now.
And of these three, like, where do you think more money will go? Cyber weapons or surveillance? Because surveillance is, I think, pretty good now. But of course, it could be better and you can do it more with drones. Cyber, of course, cyber capabilities of countries in Europe. I think the ones in the US can be improved. But so far, with all the attacks on Ukraine, there hasn't been much damage. But Ukraine generally has good tech when it comes to cyber. A lot of the software or cybersecurity engineers come from there. You think that's... Like, so where do you think there's the highest opportunity among these three?
Yeah, so I think the spend increase in absolute terms will come most at weapons, but that is most as an effect of that. That's the most capital intensive part of it. And I think that's the hardcore way to defend your country if you're under attack. So I think a lot of money will go into that. I think that probably the biggest relative increase in spend is going to be on cyber, and probably where the highest return on investment is. Mm-hmm. And I think a comment on that is that whilst fighting with weapons currently is in Ukraine, there's actually a global cyber war just now. There's an enormous amount of freelance cyber warriors fighting on Ukraine's behalf now. But of course, the Russians have a pretty forceful cyber attack force as well. But I think they're currently being outgunned by the world coming to the rescue to the extent possible through cyber war. Of Ukraine. You know, cyber war itself doesn't start a third world war. So this is something that the free world, if you like, can do to support. And it's been clear that there has been a lot of online assets down in Russia over the last week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I think depending on how good somebody is at hacking or cyber attacks, you can, you know, penetrate some nuclear thing and can start something like Third World War. But it's really hard.
Yeah, of course, I think the cyber war today has been mostly about information propaganda and taking out, shutting off things. I think, of course, if you go to attacking IoT devices, and one of those devices would be the cooling system of a nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
That's a different game. And I think that has, at least to my knowledge, not been the center of attack, and I hope that will not be the case.
And you think there'll be more people they will in Europe who will go into military now, or the weapons is mainly the existing army will have newer weapons and better weapons? What?
I think it will not be a primary freelancing exercise in Europe. That said, I think there are thousands of people volunteering in the Foreign Legion in Ukraine just at the moment. Have you seen? I know that it's been reported in Norwegian press that there are some hundreds of people in Norway who's volunteered. And I think if you look at larger companies, countries like UK and Germany and so forth, we're probably talking thousands. But I think the Foreign Legion volunteers are not trained in weaponry that makes a significant impact in the fighting that's going on. That's my perspective on it, but it's a highly unqualified perspective.
It's kind of surprising that it's still more like a traditional warfare with tanks and people, with all the drones and tech available now. Does Russia not have it? It's mainly a U.S. Phenomena, or maybe it's.
I think drones have played a significant part. I think air superiority, superiority is a very important thing in modern warfare. The Russian Air Force is far superior to the Ukrainian, but the one element leveling the playing field a little bit is that Ukraine has over the last few years acquired advanced drones. These are Turkish designed drones. I'm not 100% sure whether they're bought from Turkey or produced on some sort of license in Ukraine, but that has been an important part of the defense from the Ukrainian side, as far as I can tell.
Okay, let's go to the third one. That's countries becoming more self-reliant. And within that, I think there are a few areas. One might be, dependence on international financial system. Other may be, strategic technologies like semiconductors. What else, Arne? Weapons?
Yeah, rare earth metals.
Yeah.
Actually, in Europe, there's some talk about even food production these days. Russia and Ukraine are the two of the world's largest producers of wheat, for example. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's all from very high-tech things to like semiconductor production and this sort of thing, down to simple things like food and money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about the international, monetary system, which is mainly led by the U.S. and a couple of things which the sanctions we all hear about are mainly targeted financial sanctions on people and companies.
Institutions.
But from like a country or nation's perspective, generally your foreign reserves are in dollars, and generally they're stored outside the U.S. in other countries. And with these sanctions, you can't access your own money. So Russia has, I think, $500 billion in financial reserves, so they cannot access them now when they need it. That may, cause other countries to think about if they were ever in this situation, do they want to be dependent on the foreign exchange being in other countries when the access can be blocked? And a lot of that money moves with of something called SWIFT. That's kind of a messaging system. Do you know what it stands for, Arne? SWIFT?
It stands for, I think it's actually the organization that runs the network, and it's called something like the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications. And it's a company out of Belgium.
Yeah.
Or a corporate or whatever out of Belgium.
Yeah. So I think 11,000 banks are part of it. So when you wire money, if you ever wire money, you know you have to provide a SWIFT code. So that's, I don't know exactly how that works, but that's today a big part of how the money moves in between countries. And I think that was one of the, or I think it still is one of the promises of crypto, that you can now bring more banks into the fold, have these, you know, money go through blockchain and get reduced dependent on SWIFT. I know Ripple is one of the companies that was planning to do that. And I think Facebook with, what was the call? Libra?
Libra, and it was rebranded to something I can't remember exactly what, but it was initially called Libra.
Yeah, but that was one of the ideas that, okay, the one, I don't think they're, because all crypto wants to decentralize, they wanted to decentralize the control for these kind of systems and also not pay big fees and be fast. Like wiring money takes, I think, 48 hours or something, and it used to cost $25. I don't know how much it is now. But all that can be eliminated with crypto. And you think it makes a stronger case now for that?
Yes, I think it depends on who you are, right? I have to say, like, the current leading situation is, like, the US dollar being the reserve currency of the world and SWIFT being the primary transfer system, right? Mm-hmm. And I think if you're a Western democracy, this is not where you feel threatened, right? If you're Norway or Germany or the US or something, you are not particularly concerned about your foreign reserves being frozen, mm-hmm. Nor are you particularly concerned about being locked out of SWIFT. Mm-hmm. If you're Russia today, you're not only concerned about it, you're dealing with a real issue, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, your expected misalignment with the Western worldview mm-hmm. shapes your view on to what extent do we need an alternative. But even the Ukraine, which is aligned with the West at this time, have banking friction because of the situation, even if they're not locked out. So there's, for example, a lot of donations going on to the Ukrainian Central Bank in crypto today. Mm-hmm. So I think you know, your worldview and your risk assessment based on being misaligned depends a lot on how you view this particular strategic asset. So, for example, China has had ambitions of challenging the US as the leading economic force in the world, and also are not as aligned as Germany, for example. Mm-hmm. And therefore, a Chinese ambition has been to have a Chinese digital currency that can challenge the dollar and can be used for, you know, when China invests around the world and so forth, to have like an alternative system. There are also alternative messaging systems out there. And then, of course, you have the zero trust, fully decentralized crypto. And I think certainly there is a challenge to the status quo. And what you bet on depends on your position and your worldview, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's, you know, US and its allies have no incentive to move to anything else.
Yeah. And then if we deal with, so for example, money is central to life or to a functional living, energy is, and so forth. These are strategic assets. Then I think that, you know, given that we talked about tech and have had semiconductors up here, you know, semiconductors are sort of the core components that make the information society work, right? If you cannot get equipment with semiconductors in them, you know, your information systems break down, right? Yeah. And as of today, the production of semiconductors are on very few hands and very centralized in the Far East. But it's distributed between mainly China and Taiwan, and then various.
Yeah, I think Korea is also big.
Korea is big, and to be fair, there are some real production around the world, other places as well, both in Europe and the US. But if you start like piling up the big percentages and how critical they are, mm-hmm. you start. Being wary if you're in the West, because it's, you know, the tension around with China has been rising over the last few years. What happened to Hong Kong, and particularly the concern that China will take aggressive steps to control Taiwan. In some way, it doesn't have to be like a Ukrainian scenario, but in some way, using power and aggression to take control over Taiwan. And if that were to happen, the big majority of semiconductor production in the world is controlled by China, in which case you control information society if you take a very simplified view on it. That is a concern to the democracies of the West, if you like. And I would bet that there is going to be very aggressive, and there are already aggressive plans for semiconductor fab investments, particularly in the US, but I think this will increase significantly both in Europe and in the US as sort of a more indirect domino of what we're seeing here. So that's another prediction I have around some of the effects we're seeing of what's going on in the world today, and Ukraine is a significant part of that.
Yeah. Thanks, Arne. I think we can end here. And we wish everybody safety in Ukraine. And we hope by the time we have our next podcast, the world is a more peaceful place.
And we hope that either the common stance against Russia in economic sanctions or so forth changes Putin's mind, or that they find a way of getting rid of a dictator in ways they've figured out how to do that before.
Okay. So we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks, Arne.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.